All right, yo, what's going on, and welcome back to another edition of the Just Swinging It podcast. It's Tuesday. What's today? September 20th. And we got another show for you. I'm here with Fat Baby and John, as per normal. How have you guys been doing? I know I missed a show last night due to some unforeseen circumstances.
I've been doing well, staying busy, running around a lot, but it's good.
I've just been working and doing a little bit of deep dives into some market research, and went to the gym today, got a nice little workout in, playing basketball, and now I'm ready to talk about the markets. How about you, Chris?
Yeah, I'm doing all right. It's a pretty busy week this week because Virginia Tech has a Thursday game, and then also we're hosting like an ASE event this weekend for like kids to learn about concrete and stuff like that. So being on the board of, you know, the local ASE, I've been having to, you know, we've been planning that, and then, you know, like I said, getting ready for the game. So it's a long weekend, and obviously y'all know, but that's why I was on the podcast last weekend, because I accidentally left my phone in Virginia Tech's like football facility where the weight room and like the coach's offices and all that was, and they were like practicing and, you know, working and stuff till like midnight every night. So couldn't get my phone back for like almost a week. It was crazy, but we're back now. At least I didn't lose it. There for a second thought it may be gone, which would have sucked. But anyhow, yeah, we're going to talk about the market some today. Obviously, if everyone doesn't know, I think today kicked off the Fed meeting for this quarter, or however often they do it. But before we get into all that, might as well learn a little something about the market. So I'm going to turn it over to Fat Baby Funds, and he can try to teach us something.
So for today, I really just wanted to talk real quickly on fixed assets. When you're looking at a balance sheet, sometimes you'll see the fixed assets called on out on there. And really, that's longer term plant, property, equipment, all that kind of stuff. And it's items that were bought, are owned by the company, and are a long term expense. So they're depreciated over time. It's important to remember, sometimes there's a lot of accounting shenanigans that can go on with these, where you can revalue assets. You can do a lot of silly things with assets. So one warning I always have when people are looking at this kind of stuff is always take it with a grain of salt. Most accounting measures, especially some of the stuff on the balance sheet, and the things that aren't easily quantified, you always got to take those with a grain of salt. And that's exactly what's going on with fixed assets when you're looking at fixed assets, because companies can revalue their assets. And what I'll warn is, when companies do revalue their assets or things like that, they're not going line by line revaluing everything. It's a spreadsheet exercise where an accountant runs some quick math, throws some estimates on it because their boss told them to, and really goes from there. So it's just an area I wanted to give everybody a warning of, if they're diving in deep on the fixed asset side, looking at a company, doing some of the deep diving where you're looking at a company's assets, all that kind of stuff, always take the fixed assets with a grain of salt, especially if you're doing cigar butt investing or anything like that, where you're really doing deep dives looking for companies who are trading below the assets on their balance sheet, all that kind of stuff. Take the assets, especially the fixed assets and the stuff that's harder to quantify, with a grain of salt, because that's where accountants can get a little creative.
And I'm sure a lot of that depends on what industry we're talking about. Just being, you know, kind of in the construction industry myself, one thing that, you know, may be necessary depending on what company you're looking at is to kind of have an insight of their philosophy on some stuff. So just for example, in the construction industry, there's companies who, you know, all this heavy equipment like backhoes and excavators and cranes, all that costs a lot of money. There's companies who will buy those pieces of equipment and use them basically their whole, the whole life of the piece of equipment until it pretty much, you know, has been used where it's not really worth that much. The salvage value is not that high and it's pretty much depreciated a lot. That's one side, but there's also companies who in their head, they have, when they buy, you know, whether it's heavy equipment, vehicles, whatever, in their head, they may, you know, their philosophy may be, we use this piece of equipment down to, you know, this many hours or down to this value, and then they salvage it and upgrade a new piece of equipment, which if you think about it, makes a lot of sense because some of these heavy duty piece of equipment, the lifespan on them depends on how much they're getting used, is a pretty good amount of years. So there's going to be technological advances and stuff like that. So there's a lot of companies who have built in, hey, we're going to use it this long and then we're trading it in for a newer piece of equipment. And if you're looking into these assets, that's probably going to be reflected somehow on the balance sheet because it's always going to be rotating. It's not going to be like you bought all the equipment got bought today and in 2 years we're salvaging the equipment, selling it, and then buy a new piece of equipment. There, it's going to be all random throughout, and it's just something to be aware of. And I would, that's what industry I are familiar with, but I'm sure other things similar happen in other industries as well.
Yeah, absolutely. You got to sort of watch out for a lot of that kind of stuff. I know in my work, our business units are given a ton of autonomy. So you can have a lot of control over how you handle things. And some run their assets as long as possible, or cheap as possible, and it bites them in the butt sometimes. So their financials look really, really good until they take a big hit. So we're seeing some of that happen right now where a lot of the companies who were stretching the life of their assets, now that the supply chain's a train wreck, they're really struggling because their assets are breaking down and they can't replace them. So you got to watch out for stuff like that as well.
Yeah, that's a good point. Right now with the supply chain issues, you know, there's companies who really didn't have to still be using, you know, whatever it may be, vehicles, equipment, or whatever, but they're having to because they're not able to get a, you know, get a new one right now or in, you know, efficient enough time, which probably is putting some companies in the bind, depending on how good their planning was. John, do you have anything on the subject?
No, the only thing, I mean, not as far as like the assets on a balance sheet, I don't really know a whole lot about that. So that's good to know as far as like what's on a company's balance sheet and how much flexibility they have with it. But as far as the supply chains go right now, the drill companies that are installing the Google Fiber in the Charlotte area is having a hard time getting drills. So it's that's an asset that they have on their balance sheets as far as replacing new drills to continue doing work. So they're trying to repair old drills, but definitely something that we're kind of seeing right now because there's a big demand to put Google Fiber in throughout Charlotte, and some of these drill crews aren't able to get enough drills to install it.
Yeah, I bet.
Yeah, yep. And it's happening everywhere. It's happening in every industry.
Yeah, hopefully it gets better here in the, I guess, at least the medium time. But moving on from that, John, why don't you go ahead and give a rundown of how the markets performed this last week, and then we can jump into some of that stuff.
Sounds good. The market's been beaten down pretty heavily, I mean, since the beginning of the year, but especially here this last couple weeks. The volatility, the VIX of the S&P 500 is bullish trend. It's currently sitting around 27, and its trend is right around the 2450. So anything above that's bullish trend on volatility, which is a bearish signal for stocks. And then if you look at the price of the S&P 500 directly, we're very bearish trend. We've been bearish trend, something that I've been talking a lot about on the podcast for the majority of the year. I think I went bearish sometime in March. I'd have to look to really see through our previous episodes, but we're bearish. We're currently at 3,855. Trent is all the way up there at 41.50, so we're very bearish trend here. I look for it to continue throughout the year. If we jump over to crude oil is one that we had talked about a little bit. Once it broke below that 95 level has been something that I've been shorting and also talking about here on the podcast. We had a little bit of a conversation with a few guests we've had on the past about the crude oil thing. It's something that's definitely going to head lower. It tends to track well with our economy, and since the yield curve is inverted, that usually predicts a recession. I look for the stock market to go lower and crude oil to continue lower. Trend has actually started to fall as well, so that's also another bearish sign, is when the trend level starts falling with the market as well. So trend right now is actually at 93.50, so it's came down from the 95 level, and crude oil is currently at 84.19. So definitely bearish on oil. That was one of the biggest shorts. This was something like 3 or 4 months ago. I said crude oil will be one of the best shorts, and we waited and we made a great call here going into the last month or two, going into crude oil to keep that as a short. Now gold is bearish trend. We mentioned this. It went bearish trend back in June. It was just kind of hovering around trend, and something that's been beat down pretty hard here. It's hard to find a safe place on the long side, except for the U.S. dollar. But gold is at 1673. Trend is all the way up there at 1800. So it's very bearish trend, and trend level is falling as well. Moving over to the 10-year Treasury note, the yield is very bullish. Bonds are very bearish. This is unprecedented levels, really. We're going to yields that we haven't seen for a few years now. So it's going to be interesting to see this impact the market. I think as of right now, the Fed is doing a fair job, but the problem is they're working off of data that's months old. So what's going to happen is they're going to do a good job until they overdo it. And it's going to be like pushing a stone up a hill. You keep pushing it up a hill, pushing up a hill, and eventually it hits the peak and it starts tumbling off the other side. And that's one of the catalysts that we've been talking about this and debating this for a while, ever since the beginning of the year, that the Fed was going to make a policy error, and we're about to see the effects of that. And the market's already down. So the market's already down, and yields haven't started to fall yet. And once we start to get some momentum of the yields starting to fall down, then I wouldn't be surprised if the market was down 50% from its top. So definitely bearish news there. Another sign of economic disinflation of asset prices is the dollar being so strong relative to other currencies. Dollar has been on a tear to the upside. The euro's been, I think, at like 20-year lows or something. So definitely a bearish trend on euros, which if you are short euros, which most people don't play currencies, I actually didn't play them this time either. But if you are short, it's definitely a time to cover that. Moving on to Bitcoin, cryptocurrencies. Bitcoin is down there just under 19,000 at 18,889 and some change. Trend for it is at 28,000. So definitely not looking to buy this anytime soon. And it seems like it could start to drift lower here. I mean, it is bearish trend, but it has been beat down so much. You would think that it might start to build some kind of foundation or bottoming process here. But we don't pick bottoms here. We're going to stay with the trends. Trends bearish on Bitcoin, so we're going to stay with that. And then I got three stocks I wanted to talk about a little bit. The top three traded stocks today was Ford, Apple, and Tesla. Ford had a massive move down today. Everyone was selling. I'm not sure what caused that. The trend is at $14.81. It's currently at $13.09. So it took a big fall. I think it closed its previous day at almost $15. So it had a couple $2-3 move to the downside. So that's a big move in Ford. Do you have anything to say about Ford?
Yeah, I think what was driving it was they came out and said they were going to have like $1 billion in supply chain impacts in Q3. So I think that's what was driving it.
Yeah,
I didn't read too much into it. I just saw a few articles of basically, I don't want to call them experts, but like the banks and that sort of thing, kind of saying don't worry too much about it, that they actually still like Ford long term, but here right now there's going to be obviously impacts when, you know, they come out and say they're going to be missing a couple, you know, billion dollars, however much it was, for this quarter. It's going to obviously drive the price down in the short term.
With this move to the downside, it definitely broke trend, so something to definitely keep in mind. I mean, if your outlook is longer term, you could make a play here with that big of a move down. I mean, it was a multiple standard deviation to the downside. But the second stock...
It was like $1.50. It just happens to be cheap.
Right, yeah, still a big move in percent terms, but Apple is right at trend. It's currently at $156.90, give or take, after hours trading. Trend for that is 155. So if we get it back below 155, you got to let this one go. It's held up relatively strong. Even it being a higher, or traditionally a higher beta name, it's held up very well, more than I would expect with the market being down. So this is a stock that it'll be the last to cave in, I think. I mean, it's already, you know, down since August, but I still think that Apple will eventually roll over, break trend, and head lower towards the end of the year with the rest of the market. Tesla's bullish trend. It's 308, 307.50, somewhere in that range. I'm getting mixed numbers between the bid and the ask because of after hours trading. But trend for it is 277. So definitely bullish trend here. I could see this one moving higher. I mean, we'll stay with the trend. Tesla is definitely, I wouldn't say necessarily a meme stock, but it's definitely, it has a lot of hype, and it the way it's looking, it may be the last stock to really, really come down. I mean, we've seen it come off of its highs, but it's still drastically overvalued, in my opinion, on a fundamental level. I mean, I'm not a fundamental guy, but to me, it's just...
to me, you know, Tesla's moved so much, it's hard for me to, you know, think about playing it long, but Tesla's probably one of the better, if you have the capital to do it. Now, obviously, it's a higher price stock, so it takes a little bit more time, but one of the more decent stocks to play as far as like day trading goes. Tesla will move multiple percent up and down within a single day. So if you watch Tesla and you pay attention to it, I don't particularly do it, but there are some people I know who do play Tesla. That's one that you can, you know, pretty much find pretty decent spots intraday, just, you know, trading it for the day.
Yeah, definitely a very liquid trading vehicle. You know, liquidity is, in my opinion, the most important thing when it comes to trading, especially day trading. You don't want to pay a lot on the bid-ask spread of a stock. You want to keep those markets really tight. Especially when you're getting in and out of the market, you want to make sure there's a lot of liquidity. And, I mean, in today's time, the stocks are so liquid, and there have been a lot of people come to the markets. It's not a huge deal like it used to be, but even still, that there can be some shit names out there that you could trade, especially if you're – it's not more or less on the stock side. It's more on the option side. If you're day trading options, you definitely – which I don't day trade options, but – you definitely want to take a look at the spreads. I wouldn't do anything that's more than like 3 or 4 cent wide spreads. You want to keep with something super liquid, and Tesla is definitely one of those names.
Yeah, there's companies that have pretty large bid-ask spreads, so the liquidity in some of them are mind blowing. Like Spotify, for example, Spotify is one that you can almost even think about touching bonds, even non-stocks. If there's a time the shares of stocks, the bid-ask spread is, you know, a penny, 2 pennies. Spotify, for some reason, even buying shares is a few cents, you know, in between the bid-ask spread. And for options, it's almost impossible to even trade like the monthlies or whatever. That's one in particular where it's pretty wide. Netflix is one that's also pretty wide, but Netflix, I do trade pretty often with options, and you tend to actually get filled. You can get filled towards the upper end, so it's never really been an impact on that one. I don't, for some reason they're wide, but it also, for some reason, you can get filled at, you know, a normal price in there.
Yeah, definitely good trading out there. I've seen you post a couple posts on some trades you've been making. That's pretty much all I have. You want to talk about some of the trades you've been putting on?
Yeah, so like John mentioned, you know, we have this volatility kind of going up, especially with this Fed meeting. And, you know, like John said, they've been doing decent, but at some point they're probably going to do too much. As of right now, from what I'm reading, pretty much what's priced into the market, and we talk about this all the time, a lot of new traders or, you know, kind of hobby traders, they headlines and they get, I guess they get too ambitious or tearful headlines, but forget the fact that by the time the retail trader or retail investor finds out news events, everyone else who is trading, you know, hedge funds and tons of money who actually move markets already know that, and it's already priced into the market. This Fed meeting is one of those which, to an extent, is priced in. It's from what I've been reading, about seven, the Fed's hiking the interest rates about 75 basis points is priced into the market already. What's not priced in is if they, you know, they do more than that. So I think a lot of the fear on the, you know, the drop in the last week or so is people are afraid that they're going to raise it to basically 100 basis points. We're at 70, you know, it's priced in for 75. That's what, you know, the investors are looking for. That's what the investors seem to be fine with. It's if they raise it 100 basis points or more, or do something different. That's kind of the fear right now. That's why we're seeing, you know, the increased volatility. And we're going to find out, you know, maybe tomorrow or in a day or two, because it's, I mean, it started today. But yeah, volatility has been going up. So I've been trading, you know, kind of a lot of options on the, you know, sell side, the, you know, selling premium. It's a decent time. There's a lot of high IBRs in good names, the trade. So, you know, a lot of times there'll be high IBRs and not particularly great companies or ones that maybe I don't want to touch, but right now you can get high IVRs in Apple, Amazon, you know, Netflix. I said the bid-ask spread was pretty kind of wide Netflix, but I'll throw it in here too. But like Apple, Amazon, Google, some of these, you know, high name companies that have, you have no problem getting liquidity in, and the bid-ask spreads are tight. A lot of these companies right now have, you know, IV ranks that are, you know, upper 40s, 50s. I think Netflix is crazy right now. Netflix is upper 70s. So basically all I've been doing is I've been mostly just doing iron condors and some of these names with good liquidity, because I actually not as fearful of John that we're just going to like dip a super high amount for long term. I actually think we're in the range we're in, and we're probably going to be in the range we're in for a while. It's going to go down. It's going to go up. But I don't see like huge, huge moves that would like blow volatility up or anything like that. So I've been mostly doing iron condors in some of these, you know, names with good volatility. Right now, out to the cycle of, I think it's October 21st. That would be, you know, the main option cycle for October, which is the one people should be trading. That's the one where you have the most liquidity, you can get in and out. It's going to have the tighter spreads, and basically just been eating the premium that comes in along with the, you know, you get the theta decay when you sell the options, unlike when you buy them. And yeah, just been collecting money on the premium and theta. One of the ones I posted last week that I actually did call out on our Twitter was Roku shot up to, I think, about $74, $75 one day, which was a huge move. And I just got a short call spread looking for a, you know, it to move back down and, you know, kind of stay in that range. It had an high VR. And basically I got filled today at 30% max profit. So, you know, that if you've been listening to the show for a while, we haven't talked about it in a while because we've been focusing on kind of the financial side. But if you listen for a while and back to, or know anything about options, we always talk about you want to, you know, get the options that have the most liquidity, which would be the, you know, the main monthly cycle. You want it to be anywhere from, you know, like upper 30s to 45 days out. And then you want to close at, you know, about 21 days, or basically you want to get 50%. You want to keep 50% of the credit you received, and you typically want to do however wide your strikes are. You want to collect a third of that, or around in there. It ain't got to be exactly. So say you collect 150 on a credit on a trade, you need to start looking to close it when you get to about 75, where you've made about $75 in credit. Basically, all that does is increase your capital efficiency, because then you can get in more trades. It also makes it where all your trades aren't at the same time. But the one thing that I think people forget about, when, you know, we're not the only ones that talk about doing it this way. Tasty Trade does it that way. That's where I learned from. I think John learned that way. But a lot of people that do the premium strategies do kind of similar things there. But the one thing that I think people forget about is they get focused on that 50% profit, which, you know, would have a pretty high probability if you're looking in the, when you start out, the max profit being about 60 to 75% range is what I kind of look at. Your percent profit to make 50%, that's even higher. People get focused on that 50% range and don't think about, if you get the move in your direction right away, you might as well close it, because what? Why stay in for two or three other weeks to make barely any money? So that's one that happened on Friday. I got in, basically held it over the weekend, sold it today, and made over 30% of the max profit, and basically didn't hold it. Basically, I held it over the weekend. So that capital is ready to be deployed again. But I have a couple, trades like that, just looking on. I know I rambled on a little bit there, but just, you know, with the high premiums and stuff you can get right now in the good names, I think it's a good time to be, you know, doing a premium selling strategy, because you don't have to mess with some of these poor, smaller companies and things like that. You can do it in the larger ones, which isn't always the case.
For people that are new to options, or they might not know some of the terminology. So implied volatility is just the market's forecast for one standard deviation move of what the market volatility is going to be in the future. So in implied volatility rank is, okay, it's implied volatility versus how high volatility has been in the past. So if volatility, implied volatility, is a lot higher now than it has been over the last year for that specific stock, when you sell the option, you'll collect a bigger premium when you're selling options. And if you're buying options, you have to pay a bigger premium to have that position. So if the implied volatility is high, it doesn't really give you any context. It just tells you what the implied volatility is of the stock, which is good to know. But implied volatility rank tells you is it high relative to itself in the past year. So definitely when Chris is coming in and selling options, he's looking for something that the implied volatility of that stock is higher than it has been over the last year. And so he's saying, okay, this is more expensive than it's been. That's a good opportunity to sell it. And selling iron condors is really good because it's defined risk, and you don't have massive risk on either side. And I think personally, like he was saying, you know, I think that the market's going to continue to go down, and it might be some chop and it might take a while, but I think the market's going to go down. And I do agree that the iron condors is a really good way to play specific names that you think the implied volatility
or the move is over in. So say there's a name that you like, the stock, it's already had a big move versus the market, because some stocks you could argue are cheap or they've already had their big move to the downside and then it's over with, versus the broad market still, in my opinion, has a lot more room to go down. So if you find a specific stock and you think that it's already pretty much crashed as much as it's going to crash and its implied volatility is still elevated, then that could be a good selling opportunity if you're going to sell some options on it. So I just wanted to put that in there just to kind of clarify what Chris was talking about on his options there.
Yeah, and like John was saying about the implied volatility rank, you know, even if we do have, you know, some more drop downs, some of these that have a super high, you know, implied volatility, it means the market, what's in the market is that it's going to move a massive amount in one direction. So using iron condors on some of these, you can get, like, for example, Netflix right now, the IVR, I think, is like 80 or like upper 70s or something like that. So I can do an iron condor on the iron condor I have in Netflix. The price of the stock's at like 240. I think my short side is like 185 or something like that. And my long side's like upper 200s. And, you know, I got a really good, you know, I got a third of the width of the strikes I have a $5 wide iron condor. But if you look in there, because of the implied volatility so high, it would have to move $50 or $60 to even get to where my strikes are on some direction. So even if we go down, it's like, well, you got a long, long way to go. So like a 79, 80, like that, that's exactly when you get in. Most of the time you see more like 50s. Like I think Amazon, Apple, those are in the 50s, like 50 range, upper 40s. But the reason you sell them in this case instead of buys, like John mentioned, especially if you're one that normally buying options, you have to pay more if it's got a high implied volatility. So if all of a sudden, you know, you bought that option for and you plan to keep it a couple of weeks, it has a high implied volatility, and all of a sudden it doesn't move at all, you're going to lose money right away just from it basically not moving because you overpaid for it. Whereas when you sell them, you actually collect more money. It's basically you're overcharging for what you think it'll be in the future. That's the correct. Markets are efficient, so it's the correct price for now. But if John said, if the thought is that in this time period it's not going to move too much, it may go up, it may go down, but it's really going to be in the same range. Then yeah, you want to be able to sell something for more money than you can collect. Now, if it's got a low IVR or like low implied volatility, that's when you would buy the options and take a swing on it. The one thing I do want to point out is the last month here has been a perfect time for doing it because, you know, volatility is high. But the one thing to keep in mind, and even this month going forward to the October cycle, one thing to look at is volatility goes up when companies get near earnings, which will be about towards the expiration in the October date. So I want to stress right now that if you're getting in, you know, selling options for that October 21st date, A, you want to look at when that company is reporting earnings, whether it's after or before that date, and you want to kind of really stick to trying to get out of the trade, you know, within 21 days or right around that. You don't want to get stuck with the volatility shooting up just because it's getting near earnings when you actually had a winning trade. But that's just a 2 cents there.
Yeah, and I think that when you're selling options, there's a lot of research, like Chris was mentioning, Tasty Trades done on the selling options, and you want to really keep between that 45 and 21 day, and then you can just roll out in time if you want. But if you're buying options, which is something I don't hear people talking a lot of, I mean, people buy options, but when I say buy options, like as a part of your main part of your portfolio, say you want to purchase 100 shares of stock, and you're bullish on it, you have a couple options. You can sell. What I would do is sell an at the money put, so you'd collect a lot of premium because it's right where the stock currently is. You'd have some protection to the downside because of the premium you collect, and the premium can be good. But if you're like more bullish and you think it's going to move in a faster time frame, you can do a stock replacement strategy with a lot less capital than selling a put or buying stock. You can actually buy calls. And what I typically do if I buy calls is I'm going to buy an in-the-money option, an in-the-money call, and I'm going to keep it between 60 and 45 days. Because if you stay out there in the 60 to 45 days of expiration, you have less theta decay, and now you're going to give up a portion of the move. The options aren't going to move. In-the-money options are going to move about 70% of the value that the stock moves. So if the stock goes up a dollar, the option will go up 70 cents per dollar that the stock moves up. But what you can do is once it gets to 45 days and say it hasn't moved your way yet, you can roll out to the 60 days and just keep that contract and that call that you bought that's in the money. You just want to keep that between 60 and 45 days. If you're buying calls, it's a little bit more aggressive. But if you're going to buy calls and be strategic about it, that would be one way that you can do it and not give up a lot of theta decay as time goes on. But it's just another way to replace stock and be bullish on something without YOLO and options.
Yeah, I didn't plan for us again a super big option talk, but we are now, which we haven't done in a while, so it makes sense. We're probably boring fat baby funds to death. But to keep on from John was talking about the puts and calls. Another point to mention, and maybe we should bring back, in a month, maybe towards the end of the year, starting the new year, maybe we should do another, few weeks on just going through options again, because options are sexy. A lot of new traders think they need to jump in options, and you see mostly people buying options, which to me really isn't that good of a winning strategy. And unless you're day trading them, you're not going to lose too much on the volatility or the theta decay. If you're day trading, you can definitely use technical analysis and stuff like that to make money day trading. It's when you try to hold them for a week or two or whatever. Now, obviously, Fat Baby Funds is looking for he'll buy one for next year, which is a different strategy altogether that's not really included in this conversation. But yeah, maybe we should start going through options again. But one thing to point out when John was talking about puts and calls and that sort of thing, and I was talking about iron condors a second ago, is a lot of people freak out if, an iron condor is meant for it. You don't want the stock to move too much when you're in the iron condor. You want to just time to pass, collect your money on the time, and you want the volatility to go down. But sometimes that doesn't happen like that. Sometimes it does move. The one thing to keep in mind, I feel like people forget, and they'll just, they look at their losses and it's like, okay, let me be safe. Let me manage my risk. Let me cut this loss early if it moves, way up or way down and starting to get, closer to your strikes. The better thing I think to do would be, say you had an iron condor and it started moving down and you're a couple of dollars from your short strikes. Well, what you need to do to manage it is you need to close your call strikes, because you've made all the you basically have collected all the premium you can on the, if it moved that, down, you've already collected all the premium that your upper call spread will give you. So there's no reason to just keep it, because that's just more risk. If it goes back up, you're going to lose money on that, when you can close it and you can keep the bottom. Now all you have is a short put spread, because that's all an iron condor is you have a short call spread and a short put spread. So if you do get a movement in one direction, close the one that you've collected all the money in. There's no reason to just keep it because it just adds more risk, because you've already milked it dry. But I think that's one thing people forget about. And then the other thing I want to mention is when you're getting close to the strikes, I don't actually have the percentages on this. I know Tasty Trade actually did a segment a couple weeks ago, maybe a month ago, on this, and you can probably find it on YouTube if you wanted. But apparently, which makes sense, and it's something to keep in mind, is if the stock blows through your put spreads, you have a pretty good percent chance of it coming back above it, as long as you're buying the correct strikes and looking at what deltas you're buying. When it blows through, I think it's like the 20 delta, 25 delta they were looking at. When it blows through the put spread, it's over 50% chance that it actually will come back up. And that makes sense because the market, you know, tends to go up over time. I mean, we talk about it all the time. The market tends, you know, on average go up 8%. So there's an upward drift. There's not a downward drift. So it go if it goes down too much through your put spreads, upward drift alone, you know, there is a probability that it will come back. It's not the same if it blows through the call spread. So you want to manage different. If it goes, if you guess wrong on the, you know, the put spreads and goes through it, and if you got plenty of time left, you don't want to just close it and take your loss because, A, if you're doing iron condor like we're talking about or a spread, it's defined risk. So there's no reason to have a stop loss because the stop loss is already built in. You define the risk originally. If you have time left, give it a chance to come back because there is a good chance it comes back. The opposite is if it goes through the call, your call strikes, it is a lot lower. I think it's in the 20% that it actually goes back down to where you want it. And that's because the market as a whole has an upward drift. So if it goes through your call strikes, you know, maybe you do want to close so you don't lose, you know, the maximum amount. That's just something to keep in mind. But there's all kinds of research and stuff.
Yeah, the one thing I will say is that if it does blow through one side, I would try not to let it go to expiration because there is some assignment risk that could happen, and it doesn't happen a whole lot. But
yeah, you don't let it go through expiration. What I'm saying is, you know, if it blows through today and you have 35 days to expiration and it blows through the put side, there's no reason to freak out and close it today. Now, if it went through the call side, because you have time to get back. Now, like I said, if it goes through the call side, it's a lot less chance that it goes back down just because the market tends to go up.
Yeah, but I just don't want people to hold the expiration on if you're selling call spread or something.
You shouldn't be holding the expiration anyhow, like we were talking about before. You know, if you're looking to get about 50% of what credit you originally received, and if you do that, you'll have a higher probability of success, a higher probability of making money, as well as keeping your capital efficiency up because you're closing, you're getting into more trades, you're closing quicker, and you're collecting money. So, you know, I try not to hold the expiration at all. Every once in a while, you get stuck in one that looks like it's probably going to be a winner, and you have to hold it, you know, a little longer, but once it gets to like a week out, I'm trying to get out of them.
Yeah, I don't see reasons to hold any options to expiration, even if I'm buying calls or puts. I just buy them in the money and I keep them out in time and just roll them out. And it's a good stock replacement, especially if you have if someone has a smaller account or you are trading a large product that the share value is super high, and you don't want to sell a put because it can be pretty capital intensive, or you don't want to buy a bunch of shares, but you still want to be long 100 shares. You can do it with less money by buying a call, and you can do that out in time and just continue to roll it out in time, and you'll still collect a high percentage of the move. But yeah, definitely want to talk more about options later, and maybe even talk a little bit about futures going forward just for a day or two.
Yeah, definitely. Maybe toward, like I said, once we get to the new year, we can sit down and decide what topics we want to talk about, you know, start the year off. But like John said, you can trade options as a stock replacement because it uses less capital, but do want to point out that's only in margin accounts, of course. And you want to keep in mind, you know, how much cash you have in there because you do have to close trade. So if you collect 300 credit and you're looking to close at 50% of that, you're going to need $150 to close, you know, the trade. So you got to make sure you don't burn your cash all the way down, which you shouldn't be doing anyhow. And you don't want to make so many trades that your margin's all the way down, because if the stock moves a lot, you'll end up getting a margin call and getting yourself into quite a mess, I guess. And then John mentioned not holding to expiration. I guess the only time to hold till expiration, and we've talked about this on here before, is, and this is where options can be useful to long-term investors who aren't really into options. Most people think about, you know, once they have a certain amount of shares, selling covered calls and weigh out the money and just collecting, you know, a small amount of premium on the shares they already own. Basically interest is basically what that is. You can also do the same thing on the opposite end. If you're looking to buy, you know, 100 shares of stock and hold, you know, go long, instead of just buying it right away, you can sell a put and you're going to collect, you know, whatever credit you collect there. And if the stock goes up, then you're going to collect, you're going to make all the money that you collect in credit and you're going to gain a profit. If the stock goes down, you're actually just going to get it at a better price anyhow. So that's one thing to, you know, keep in mind if you're a long-term investor. Fat Baby, you got anything to add on options? I would guess not. Or any questions, I guess.
No, just be safe, y'all. Options are fun. They're educational. But I'd recommend everyone play small with them. Put 1% of your portfolio in them until you really got everything figured out.
And that's why we talk about defined risk. That's, you know, on the sell side, if you're buying options, you're already on defined risk because the most you can lose is how much you paid for it. If you're selling them, that's not the case. Like if you sell a put at $50, it can basically go all the way down to zero, and that's how much per 100 shares that you're gonna owe. But so what I would recommend for newer people is not to do naked options. I don't really even do naked options all that often because, you know, it is a little more capital intensive. You got to have a little more build up. It takes a lot more buying power. But what you can do is do spreads, which means if you want to sell a put, you can go a couple strikes below that and buy a put as well. And then all you can lose is the width of your spreads minus the credit, basically, and that's your max, you know, that's the max you can lose. So those are already defined risk trades, like the iron condors and, you know, put spreads, call spreads. Those already have defined risk. So if you're new, I would start with something like that because you can, you know, you keep your spreads tight, you know, maybe $2 or something like that, and you're going to have $200 basically at risk, and you know that going in, the most I can lose on this is $200. So basically it keeps you out of all the kind of the margin trouble and that sort of thing when you're first starting out. But yeah, we've been going for a minute, so we'll wrap it up pretty soon. But I guess the one big news story that's kind of funny that I think we have to talk about just because it's so outrageous is this Beyond Meat COO. So if anyone's listening, don't know, and if you've been trading Beyond Meat, you might want to, I don't know, I don't even know what you would do. I assume this will have some sort of impact because they're going to have to find a new CEO, COO, not CEO. But basically the COO of Beyond Meat was at the Arkansas, and they were playing a small team, I think from the Ohio Valley Conference, Missouri State, the other day, which they should have lost the game. The only reason they won the game is because they returned it like an 80-yard punt in the fourth quarter and then immediately had like a screen pass for like 70 yards and scored two touchdowns back-to-back, basically. That's the only reason they even beat this team, and Arkansas was ranked 10th in the country. Anyhow, the COO, I guess, was drunk and got in a fight afterwards and bit some dude's nose off and got arrested, and they charged him with like some assault charges, some terrorism threat charges, stuff like that. So he's in quite a bit of mess, but I saw that, and I mean, that's a crazy, crazy story.
Yeah, I've seen that.
Yeah, I mean,
he finally wanted some meat.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of jokes going around about how off-branded it was.
Yeah, one fold Mike Tyson on him.
Yeah, I want to know more of what happened. I feel like you don't just get in a normal fight and bite somebody's nose off, especially if you're like a pretty high-ranking executive.
And when you're losing a fight and you're drunk, you're just grasping at straws, and you just I don't know, maybe the guy just had a big honker and he was like, hey, you know, I've been eating this fake ass meat. I want some of that.
Yeah. I would expect that from like a big SEC game, say Arkansas was playing like LSU or Alabama, Georgia, but they're playing like Missouri State. I don't think I'm losing my high ranking job and stuff like that over a game where we're playing, you know, Missouri State, who's barely recently an FBS program, but just thought that was crazy. So, but to swing that full circle, you know, something like that happens, Fat Baby. How, and you're not going to know the answer because I'm sure your company never had an executive bite somebody's nose off. But how does a company handle something like that? How should shareholders look at something like that? Because I mean, he's in major trouble. He's probably going to jail. They're going to have to find a COO. If you are a shareholder in Beyond Meat, what should you be doing right now as far as, you know, when they're looking at candidates, or especially since this is a situation where they're going to give the public no information, what should you be doing? Because COO is a high ranking position.
Yeah. For companies like this, what they should be doing is having HR meetings where they have talent reviews to go through the pipeline for every major position. And COO would be one to say, okay, who do we have in the pipeline that's ready to step up for this position? And that'd probably be just a meeting with I'd imagine the CEO and then maybe the director of HR when you're at that level. But when you're at those higher level positions, there always should be some sort of contingency planning. Now, there should be. Sometimes you plan and you say, we don't have anyone. So then you put together a 1 to 2 year plan to develop someone, and then that person bites someone's nose off and you get screwed. So there's not a ton you can do. But usually there's some sort of contingency planning. There's a list that already exists. Here's the plan. If this person leaves, here's the options. Here's what we would do. So usually companies should be pretty quick to act, and they should either fire him immediately, or if they think there's something else going on here, some sort of fake news, something like that, so suspend him until you get a little bit more information. But that's what I've seen companies do in the past, is usually they're pretty quick at filling those kind of positions. If they do have a contingency plan and someone already planned on it, sometimes you don't have anybody.
Yeah, and I would say that most companies tend to jump the gun. We're not a podcast where we judge people. In America, you're innocent until proven guilty. I just find it hard for them not to know whether you bit somebody's nose off, and he does have mugshots. So I'm going to lean on the side that he probably did bite the tip of somebody's nose off in this case. In most cases, I would say you got to wait and kind of see what comes of it. But in this case, I think it'd be pretty easy to figure out whether this guy bit somebody's tip of their nose off. But yeah, that makes sense, having, you know, kind of a contingency plan. I guess from a shareholder perspective, what would you think of, you know, I guess a big executive all of a sudden left, and obviously in a situation like this, you're not going to get, the shareholders aren't getting going to get that much information out of the company until they, you know, nail down what they are going to do, whether they put somebody in interim and stuff like that. Until they nail that down, you're not going to get that much information. But if some news came out and you have a big holding in a company like this, how would you approach? What would you do as a shareholder? Let's, for example, say Spotify or something.
Yeah, I think you just got to watch really closely the way management responds. There's definitely been some weird ones. I don't know if you ever saw the video of the Peloton's, one of the lead Peloton instructors' wife. She's like a musician, and there's a video of her peeing into someone's mouth. So sometimes you get things like that coming out, and you're like, okay, I own Peloton stock. What the hell do I do with this?
Hey, we're not going to kink shame here. That's a totally different deal. I don't think his wife pissing in someone's mouth falls
at
business.
At a concert and in front of everybody.
Yeah, that's getting a little wild.
Yeah. It's not like it was some pinky home video shit going on. This was at a concert. She came off the stage and squatted in this dude's face and pissed on him. Like, what?
Hey, so, when you gotta go, you gotta go.
Yeah. Yeah, it was the most confusing video I've ever seen.
Pretty hot.
But so when something you just sort of watch and you say, okay, does this actually impact anything? How much of your thesis was originally based upon that COO being great? A lot of times, if it's a higher flying stock like that, you do put a lot of faith into the management. So when you do get something like that, it's a little discouraging. But I'm buy and hold, so I probably wouldn't overreact to anything, but just keep watching it.
I guess the next question I have among the same kind of same subject is, do you think something like this impacts a smaller company like Beyond Meat or like a larger company, say a larger company, a very high ranking official, let's say COO, CEO, somebody like that of, let's say, a company like Apple, or, you know, maybe that's too big. Maybe it should be even smaller than that. But, you know, a pretty large company, does that have a bigger impact on them or someone like Beyond Meat or Peloton or one of these smaller companies? Which would have a bigger impact of, you know, say, a high-ranking executive leaving as far as, like, the business continuing forward as well as just from an investing perspective?
I think it sort of depends.
Yeah, go ahead, John.
Oh, I was just going to say real quick, I think it depends on the complexity of a company. If a company is, you know, into tech and the CEO is also a founder or something, then I think it's really important. But if you're a meat company, I don't know how complex it really is to run a meat company business, or not a meat company, but a alternative meat product company, you know, how complex that is, and it seems more replaceable in simpler industries than it is something complex like the replacing Steve Jobs seemed like a bigger task in that industry than it would be an executive in something like me.
See, my thoughts would be it's kind of both sides. You know, you have a large company that's been around, the people in the executive positions, they're not the original people in the executive positions. Even if they leave, there's somebody else there that's been there a long time. It's more of a well-oiled machine. So it seems to me like they may be able, that they'll have they'll definitely have better planning and be able to jump on something right away. But on the other side of that, like you said, you know, it's a large company with a lot of tech. They have a lot more business, a lot more things that, you know, probably matter on a day-to-day basis. If someone, you know, high up leaves, you know, the next person may have a totally different mindset and could send the company in a complete different direction, which could be a big impact. But then if you look at a small company, you know, they're trying to build the company up. So the people in some of these executive positions, they may be the first ones that were in that position. They may have, you know, been, you know, the reason the company has grown that much. So if they take off, all of a sudden there is nobody there that's, you know, can just step in and knows what's going on. That's just my thoughts. So Fat Baby, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, we've seen some of it. I mean, Sheryl Sandberg retired, left Facebook. And you could see Facebook was immediately ready. So sometimes it all depends on who they have waiting in the wings. Facebook had some strong candidates ready to.
They wanted her to leave too, also, right? Like they didn't. Yeah, say they that. Were. They forced her out.
Yeah, I don't know if they forced her out, but they were definitely there were rumblings around how much time she was spending on her wedding, her daughter's wedding, something like that, and whether it was Facebook time, all that kind of stuff, how many new Facebook resources she was using on that, all that kind of noise was happening too. So she'd been around for a while, but she was a major part. She essentially ran the major business portion of it. So it's a big deal. But overall, the market didn't react too poorly when that happened, and I think it's because they sort of had a plan going into place. But there's sometimes when some of these companies, they'll lose a CFO and they'll let it sit open for a long time. And a lot of times it depends on what you want. So CFOs, you'll see them come external a lot. Sometimes you'll see them internal. When Barry McCarthy left Spotify, they promoted their director of investor relations to CFO. So you'll see that sometimes, but you'll see a lot of people going outside because they want somebody with experience in public markets. So they think the CFO is more important to be experienced in the public markets than in that company. But COOs, those kind of positions, if you start taking those external, I'd have a lot of questions.
Yeah, because you want somebody in those positions who have been around, and you know, if you've been in the company, you obviously believe in the product. When you start bringing, you know, external people in, they're coming in to, you know, because it's a better job than what they had, more times than not, I would assume. But yeah, I think with some of these bigger companies here recently, there's been a lot of shifting from company to company. Like, hasn't a lot of people, like an executive from, you know, large company A went to Netflix, or there was like somebody from Netflix went elsewhere. They've been like switching back and forth up there here recently. Yeah. But there's do what?
Yeah, a lot of times it's not the major executive positions. A lot of times it's a higher level executive, which I think is a little easier to do. When you start having a COO come external, we feel it at work because they send all of our COOs, like it's on like a 5-year cycle, but they send them from overseas because we're owned by a foreign company. So the company that owns us sees it as a little breeding ground to go train someone in my company. So it's sort of interesting because they don't fully understand it. It takes them a year or two to get up to speed before you can tell, okay, now this person really sort of understands what's going on.
Yeah. And then you get pushed out by the intern, right? Yep. How much longer do you think you have? About a couple months, and he's probably got it under control.
We can only hope. I could go for some time off.
I don't know if John knows that story. So John, I don't know if it was an intern, but didn't someone like recently like come to you who you were like hiring or something like that and basically told you that your job was becoming automated and they were going to take your position or something like that?
Yeah, someone came to me on like a career conversation saying, hey, I've been told that if I want to progress in my career, the next logical step would be there's like a couple of me in my company. And so they say, hey, your position would be the next logical step. Can you talk me through sort of what you do on a day to day, what you would need to know, all that kind of stuff? So I talked him through, and then at the end he says, well, I don't really want your position. I think it's going to get eliminated anyways. And I'm like, well, what the hell, dude?
Yeah.
That's a big slap in the face. Why would you, even if you thought that, why would you just say that to somebody?
I don't know, but he's got some confidence.
That's pretty rough.
It's either going to help him or hurt him at some point.
Dang.
Yeah. Yeah, that's crazy. But before we wrap up, I guess the only other crazy thing I've seen in the news recently is, have y'all seen this like Adam Levine stuff where he like cheated on his wife or whatever?
No, I hadn't.
So Adam Levine apparently cheated on his wife, but that's not the crazy part of the story. He's a person that everyone thinks super sexy, and I think the person he cheated on his wife with was some like Victoria's Secret model or something like that. So, but anyhow, the crazy part of the story is allegedly, and I don't know if this is true or not, allegedly, I guess they just had a baby kind of recently. Allegedly, when they were having the baby, the name he was pushing for was the name of his mistress, which is a crazy move. Like, he was trying to name his newborn daughter the name of the lady he was cheating with, which is wild.
Damn, I was listening to some Maroon 5 earlier today.
Yeah, apparently he said it wasn't sexual, it was an emotional affair, which that's not true.
What the hell? What kind of shit is that? How do you have an emotional affair?
I guess I just hang out and talk.
Yeah, right.
Maybe it was emotional. Maybe he's coming out as gay or something, and he just needs someone to talk to. Who knows, John? Could be. Could be. Anyhow, we'll catch y'all next week. If you're not following us yet, do so on Twitter at Swinging It. There's no just in the handle. It's at Swinging It. Also follow Fat Baby Funds as well. Check out his financial blog. And we'll talk to y'all next week after all this Fed stuff's over. Tell you how it went.
See you guys.
The contents of this week's episode of the Just Swinging It podcast are for educational and entertainment purposes only. All persons are only given their opinions and are not to be considered financial advice. The Just Swinging It podcast isn't responsible for any financial actions you may take based on the conversations held on this show.